House Information Management and Technology Committee will come to order. We have a couple of things to do on the agenda. One, we're going to look at the Computing and Network Infrastructure Consolidated, that's scenic, projected business case update. That'll be Don Fleming and the Department of Administrative Services. Then we're going to have a hearing on sex offender registration program, and we have several of you signed up for that. We're going to start with the scenic program, and Representative Jeff Krupp has joined us. Jeff serves on the subcommittee, budget subcommittee, and wants to hear about scenic. And with that, we'll ask Don Fleming to come and tell us about the plan.
He's going to let Mike Freeze read.
Actually, it'll be myself. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Freeze, Deputy State Chief Information Officer. Here today to talk with you about the Computing and Networking Infrastructure Consolidation Project, the scenic project, and to give you the business case update that we had talked with you about before. You have in front of you a handout, which I'll walk through fairly quickly. The thing you're probably most interested in is numbers, and that's what we've talked about before. What are we going to save? And I'll talk about this as we get into the presentation. Very quickly, when we turn to slide two, I want to set a little bit of context here. Why did we go after this project? Well, the compelling reason was we're trying to produce savings. So we want to be able to reduce costs while maintaining or improving service levels through consolidation. And we thought that there was an opportunity to do that because these kinds of things, data centers are the kinds of things that when you achieve economies of scale, you can reduce your operating costs. They're more efficient the more you consolidate them. The scenic project has 12 participating agencies. We're going to end up consolidating in a new state-of-the-art data center in Salem. And there's a shared services governance model, which I've described before this committee before, that will oversee the resulting shared service. You can think of this coming biennium as a transitional biennium. This is the point at which we'll be doing the consolidation, and the savings that I'll talk about will begin occurring at the earliest in the following biennium, because there are costs that are required to transition from where we are today, a decentralized environment, to a consolidated environment, and then there are savings that result from that, and over a period of time, the savings pay back the one-time transition costs, and I'll talk to you in more detail about that further along. Again, we're going to achieve lower cost, better service than we can produce today because we're operating at a very small scale. I think I've mentioned to you before that if you take our three largest data centers, we only achieve collectively about 60% of what by industry standard would be considered medium-sized. And if you add in the other nine participating, we get to about 76%. And if you add in a lot more infrastructure, what remains in the executive branch of government, you still only get to about a medium-sized data center. So we'll never reach the point of diminishing returns that you get through economies of scale. We're also going to be able to achieve around-the-clock operation, improve our security posture, our risk profile through better cybersecurity, to be able to have managed, measurable service levels, which nobody really has the capacity to do today, and have the available capacity for growth. We can reduce costs. That's what the business cases have shown us. We've also learned through this analysis process that there are some unacceptable risks in the current environment that, irrespective of cost savings, even if we weren't saving money, we would have to solve these problems. This is a project that allows us to save money and solve some of those critical problems. I mentioned before that we don't have a good disaster recovery capability today. That's not because people don't know we need it, but we're operating at such a small scale today, those things almost become unaffordable luxuries. By consolidating, we're able to achieve, again, some economies of scale that allow us to do that more effectively. Inadequate physical and cybersecurity, obsolete and aging equipment. If you take a look at our Windows environment in the data centers, many of those systems are 3 to 5 years old now. So they're at or outside what we would call the tech curve for that equipment, and they're going to need to be replaced. And the facilities that we have today, none of them are really adequate to house a data center. The new data center that is being built has just received what's called Tier 3 certification, and that means that it's a highly reliable facility. It's designed to be a data center. The current infrastructure also will not support the state as it goes forward, as it needs to begin integrating systems to be able to deliver electronic services to citizens and to businesses in the state. and it will not, it does not provide a good platform for us to do to implement enterprise systems. So we really can't stay where we are, again, irrespective of the cost, but there are cost savings that we get out of the project, and that is a primary reason for doing it. So why did we do a business case? Well, I can probably come before you and say it's intuitively obvious that there's a savings opportunity just by looking at our current environment, but we wanted to have a factual basis on which to make any business decisions here. So what the business case did, and what a business case is, in this case what we're talking about is what I call a top-down analysis. So we're taking the data we have about our current environment. How many systems do we have? What are their configurations? What are the costs that are required to operate those systems, and how many people are associated with that? And then we compare those to industry benchmarks for the same kind of complexity and size, and we can determine from that what the potential savings opportunity would be. That's what the initial business case was about, and what you're seeing today is a more refined version of that top-down analysis, and that's important to understand because what we're doing now is we're actually building the budget from the ground up for the data center, and we're also going through each agency that's participating and taking a look at what comes out of those agency budgets, and the scenic budget, which will come forth shortly, will reflect those actual numbers. So what the purpose of the top-down business case is one, give us a likely range of savings with a reasonable margin of error in it, consider the different kinds of benefits and investments that need to be made, and helps us set a target for what the potential savings opportunity is.
Mike, when that business case is drafted, is that a written document?
What you have before you is the high-level presentation. The business case itself is actually multitudes of detailed spreadsheets, and there are documents that describe, for instance, the technology, what we call the technology architecture, where we're going to. So I'll give you a simple example. Today we have three mainframe computer systems that are in scope for consolidation. We're going to be moving to a single mainframe computer system, and we'll be migrating the three agencies onto that single mainframe. That's one of the strategies through which we're going to achieve some economies of scale and savings. So the business case describes the strategy, and it describes the costs that have to be incurred to transition from where we are today to where we're going to be. It also describes the before and after cost scenarios, so you can see what the savings
are. And that business case has been drafted.
Yes. Well, that's actually, the high-level presentation you're getting today is that business case, and we have a more detailed one that shows the actual cost.
If I wanted to look at a written document, is there a written document that says on the front of it, business case?
This is the document that you would get that's the business case.
Thank you.
Again, gives us a factual basis for making the decisions and supports the business and political decisions by evaluating the various choices and options. An example, we looked at whether it made sense to consolidate to two or a single data center. It makes sense in the state of Oregon's case to go to one because of the scale and also because operating two data centers is inherently inefficient. You'd have to run at a much lower capacity level to be able to function as a backup site for each other. And it also creates a benchmark now against which we can track performance and measure the success of the project as we move forward. It's an estimate of cost savings and benefits with a reasonable margin of error. It tells you whether it makes sense to go after the project and do it. It's not a detailed implementation plan and budget. That's what we're in the process of developing right now, today.
We asked last January for a business case or a plan, and this is it.
No, it is not. Mr. Chair, let me describe where we are in the planning process. When I came before you in January, I talked about the four stages in phase two of the scenic project. The first stage is what we call architecture, and the architecture describes the technical environment we're going through. It helps us answer questions like, today we have four or five different versions of Unix systems out there. So what is the one or two versions of Unix systems that we're going to be migrating to? What is the hardware and the software? Those are that's the process we've just finished. That helps us refine what the cost is going to be.
For architecture, is there a plan for that?
Yes, there are many architecture documents that have been produced as part of the overall scenic project plan.
But a plan from DAS for architecture. If I said, Mike, go to your shelf and get that loose leaf notebook that shows me architecture, would there be a book like that?
Mr. Chair, we could get you the architecture documents. We have those. Those have been produced as deliverables and as part of this project. The next stage of the project that we're engaged in currently is what we call detailed design. This is the actual migration strategy. So, for example, what is the specific time frame that each agency transfers into the new data center, and are we going to go agency by agency, or are we going to do what we would call a platform consolidation? And in reality, we'll probably do a little bit of both. So we'll look for that low-hanging fruit. We'll go after the big agencies first, meaning ODOT, Department of Administrative Services, and Department of Human Services, because that's where the bulk of the savings opportunity
is. When you talk about design, Mike, is there a document? For example, I know that we talked about, and had some interesting visuals of columns going on scooters across the street into the scenic building, and I'm sure that that's not the plan, but there must be a plan that we have the appropriate technology, we have the appropriate switch between technology. Probably a vendor would loan us a mainframe to run on while we do the switch. Is there a plan for that?
Mr. Chair, yes, there is. Let me back up and talk about the scenic project plan, which I believe we have shared with you earlier on. It's a 100-plus page document that describes the project. Okay.
No, saw that document.
Okay. I thought we had provided that to this committee back around January. Perhaps we didn't, but we'd be more than happy to provide that again.
Presentation document also? I did get a presentation document.
Yeah, you had the presentation document. There's also a detailed project plan. That's a written project plan that describes in detail not only the project itself, and at that time, remember, we hadn't completed the subsequent stages, so we couldn't tell you what the architecture was. What we could tell you then was the process we were going to go through to determine what the architecture was and the detailed planning. So what we do is we update that plan as this becomes more and more refined. Today, that plan includes a description of the architecture, where we're going. And as we go through this iterative process of defining a specific migration strategy, we update the plan, and it becomes more and more complete. So we can provide that to you.
Okay.
Again, this is part of it. It is an iterative process. The first business case was based on assumptions and the available information we had then. This has been a discovery process, and as we get into more and more detail, we learn more, and we can replace some of the assumptions with actual factual data that's been validated and verified, and that's what you're going to see today. We're closer. The estimate we have today is more accurate than what we had before because we have more information available. Again, the business case identifies the key savings opportunities. What we want to be cognizant of here is consolidating things that actually produce economies of scale and we can save money. We don't want to necessarily look at things that don't add to that business case. So there are some cases where, for instance, the state still has some systems that will be phased out, that become obsolete over the course of the next year or so. Wang computer systems that we don't intend to consolidate because they will go away and there are no economies of scale to consolidate those. The other thing that happens is that we identify some future opportunities. If you think of Scenic as sort of the foundation on this building, there are a number of...
You go on to slide 6?
I'm on slide 7.
I'd like to go back to benchmarks.
Certainly.
I did get a short calendar back in January, and I was under the assumption that we would get a more detailed firing order of agencies coming into the building. We did have a date finish on the building. Is there a day-to-day plan for doing that movement with benchmarks on it? I mean, other than at a building finish benchmark and several of the agencies moving in, 30,000-foot level stuff, I certainly don't want to go down to ground level, but is there something in between those two that shows me some sort of a planned process for this move?
Mr. Chair, yes, there is. There's the project plan, and then we also have a schedule that we have to update as we refine the lift strategy. We're in the process of refining that lift strategy, but we could show you what our best guess of that is today.
At this stage of the game?
Right, yeah. I mean, I can tell you that we would look at the large three agencies going first. Okay, and the original strategy, this was back when the original business case was done. Department of Human Services would be the first agency consolidated, Department of Transportation second, and Department of Administrative Services third. There are a variety of technical and economic reasons for doing
that. And you have that written down? And
we do, and that we will revise that based on additional information that we've learned along the way. And I think I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, it's probably not going to be a pure agency-by-agency consolidation. We would actually go after common platforms, so we might do a common platform in all three of those large agencies at the same time. Okay. Back on to page 7, again, there are additional opportunities that are enabled as a result of conducting this consolidation project, such as directory services, email consolidation. Those things become easier to do because we have the computing and the networking infrastructure now consolidated. If you look on page 8, this is a diagram that describes the process that we've gone through and where we are today. What you're looking at today is the updated top-down scenic business case. And this is the last of what we call the top-down analyses, because now we're dealing with real numbers and real information. We're building the case from the ground up. So what happens is that the process that we all use to build budgets, the legislative budget process, now will subsume this top-down analysis, and it'll actually prove the top-down analysis. This will show that the top-down analysis was valid with a reasonable margin of error. So we're not going to do another top-down business case. What you're going to see next is a budget for the data center, and you're going to see a budget for each of the agencies and how their budgets will be adjusted as a result of Scenic going forward.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Krupp.
Thank you. Frankly, I have to be honest with you, Mike. I'm holding in my hands Legislative Fiscal Dallas's budget here for DAS, and there's a $76 million appropriation here in package 450-451, mm-hmm. plus an additional $2.5 million here under capital construction. That's a total of $78-79 million more you're asking us to approve in expenditure, and you've spent $20 million on that facility so far, which was the E-Board appropriation. I'm having a little trouble deciding why I should approve that expenditure without a detailed cost analysis in front of my face to look at. And you're asking us to do this because, according to your timelines in here, you're not going to present that to us until July sometime, and we're probably not going to be here. I know my Democrat friends don't think that, but I think that we won't be here.
What are you going to be for? I'm saying June
4th. No, I'm just looking at you. So I'm having a little trouble with this. In fact, I'm having a lot of trouble with it. I don't view this as a... This is a nice presentation document, but it doesn't tell me what I need to know. It doesn't tell me all the money that we've spent on this project, all that we're going to spend. If I look at the payback timelines here, they don't include $100 million worth of expenditures, which is what I'm seeing in budgets here. So I guess I need some clarification on that. And I think the chairman shares my view on that. So I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, where we go from here, to be honest with you, but overviews are great, but until I see a detailed cost analysis that's really going to show me when the payback's going to be, I'm not willing to go forward in terms of ways and means. And that's why I'm here at this meeting today.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, if I could respond to that. What I just said a couple of minutes ago is that you will see the budget. That is the document that we're working on producing now, and that will answer the very questions that you're asking right now. It tells you,
Mike, I'm very concerned that you're working on to produce now mm-hmm. the architecture, the design, the project plan, and the schedule. This is a huge project, and as late as 5 months ago, I asked you and I asked Don, is there a plan? And we got an overview. And along we come, and we're going to get the plan very late in the legislative schedule, but I'm patient with that. But I have no notion, no reassurance other than two overviews that what we're having is even planned. This is the second time I have asked for a document. And I have gotten documents, but they're overviews. They're slideshows. I don't want to get down and muck around in the planning of the move from each of the agencies into the building. That is not my job. But to not have a plan produced tells me you don't have one. And that is very disconcerting for me. $72 million worth of... We had the biggest fiasco we've had in state history with the Department of Transportation. And to let this project go on with no more assurances than I have now is almost impossible. I don't want another ODOT. I don't want my committee tied to another ODOT. And I have not seen an architecture document. I have not seen a design document. I have not seen a benchmark document. I have not seen a schedule other than this. And I could make one of those on a computer myself. So I'm going to have to ask you to bring some of those documents to this committee and show us that there is, in fact, a human services plan. We have 95 people. We don't know where they're going to go. We've talked to the agencies, and through attrition, it was said, and through this and through that, I have one committee member that's very concerned. Mm-hmm. And we see no plan. So we're going to suspend testimony, and I want you to come back Tuesday, and I want you to have a sheaf of documents under your arm, not for me to examine, but to reassure me that there is a plan. And I don't see one now. I just don't see it. So we'll suspend this discussion until you can bring me something to look at that has some meat and potatoes to it, so I can say the $72 million isn't taking us down the trail that we went with ODOT 5 years ago. I'm not comfortable. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are you comfortable? I better check with my committee. Are you satisfied with what I've asked for?
Mr. Chairman, this committee, on Tuesday, full plan. I think I understand very clearly what you've asked for, and I agree with you 100%.
Oh, I'm fine with that. This information here, I think, is a lot of what we received during the JL's Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology, JLCIMT. But I actually think that the plan was a little bit more detailed for us at that point than what we're seeing here. And I understand what it is that you're after, and I'll look forward to seeing the information come forward from the department.
I agree. I just I'm still interested in knowing how many of the public employees that currently have in IT will lose their jobs as a result of this consolidation. And the total FTE, I know that I've gotten an estimate that 70% of the cost savings will come from a reduction in FTE. But I have not yet got a full answer about a final tally or a total tally from department heads on the total headcount. So that's really what I'm looking for. And the possibility of retraining.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, you know, we have had this this conversation before, and you know, we've talked about the economies of scale and reducing costs and quantifying the financial impact, baselines, benchmarks. To me, the bottom line is the measurables. We need to know what we're going to be measuring success or failure of this project against, and it's always been my understanding that's what the business case would provide us, and we need to see that.
Thank you. With that, we'll see you Tuesday. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will now open the public hearing on 3486.
I didn't want to go to the information function. It's your call.
Pardon me. Excuse me, I'm going to. We'll go to an information briefing first on sex offender registration.
Captain Mowry and Sam and
yes. Mm-hmm. Captain Mowry, Lieutenant Salazar, and Viadidi, and you come as a team? Thank you, Captain.
I had a their poster here.
Chair Dowd, members of the committee, my name is Sam Salazar. I'm a lieutenant representing Oregon State Police. I manage the major crime section, and the sex offender registration unit is a unit within that section. We're here to test today to provide testimony on 34, House Bill 3486, a bill that would require Oregon State Police to provide a sex offender website. If I may, what I'd like to do is here with me is Vi Beatty, by the way, the sex offender manager, and I'd like for her to provide the committee some quick historical review as it applies to this bill, and along with some numbers and description of the current operation. I think it would be helpful.
Thank you.
Chair Dallum, members of the committee, I'm Vi Beatty, representing the Oregon State Police Sex Offender Registration Unit. In the handout that's up there, there's a complete history of sex offender registration in the state of Oregon. I'm just going to hit the highlights. In 1989, the first registration laws were enacted. Community Corrections was responsible for all registration at that time. It began when someone was released from parole or sentenced to probation. It ended 5 years from the completion date of their supervision. The basic information was entered into LEDS. At that time, there were no criminal penalties for failing to register. In 1991, crimes were added for the registration requirement. The Interstate Compact Agreement on Adult Offenders were subject to registration at that time. Supervised offenders registered with Community Corrections. Post-supervision offenders were required to register with State Police. Annual registration and 30 days of an address change was enacted into law. Penalties were added for noncompliance. The lifetime registration change with the ability for petition for relief from registration after 10 years was enacted, and OSP was mandated to maintain an 800 number for victims to get information regarding their offenders. In 1993, the predatory designation was created for specific crimes, and non-mandatory public notification was made at that time. In 1995, offenders from other states or jurisdictions were added. Misdemeanor sex crimes included in offenses, misdemeanor sex crimes were included in offenses that were not eligible for petition for set-aside convictions. Predatory community notification authority was extended to local law enforcement after termination of supervision. At that time, paper files were maintained by Oregon State Police with Polaroid photos in them. Youth offenders adjudicated for certain sex crimes were required to register for life, and youth could now be considered predatory and were subject to notification, as were adults. In 1997, adult supervising agencies were mandated to provide additional information to Oregon State Police. Youth authorities and juvenile departments were mandated to provide Oregon State Police access to their files. Oregon State Police was prohibited from disclosing offender information at that time. In 1999, we brought our registration laws into compliance with the Jacob Wetterling and Megan's Law Acts on the federal level. There was a central registry established at Oregon State Police. Public access to information on offenders was solicited by phone or in person through Oregon State Police, as well as public access over the Internet was authorized by legislation. New crimes were added to the list of those requiring registration, and Oregon State Police developed software to provide public website access to offender information. It was tested, and it was ready to implement at that time. There were court injunctions filed in Marion County Circuit Court which prohibited the release of information over the Internet at that time. In 2002, legislation regarding predatory and posting only predatory to the Internet was added. Juvenile registration relief was enacted so that 90 days at the end of past the end of their registration, 90 days past the end of their supervision date, they could petition the court for relief from registration. Oregon State Police or local law enforcement could make predatory designation. The parole board was designated, could make designation for predatory of persons on supervision, public notification. State Police had three requirements so that we could make predatory designation. One was that the parole board had designated the person predatory while on supervision. Public notification other than to family members had been made, and they were released with a high level of supervision. An additional court injunction was filed in 2002 against Oregon State Police, so we could not post people to the internet. Which brings us to 2003. In March of that year, those injunctions were vacated. However, due to budget cuts, we laid off approximately 129 troopers and 125 professional staff, which doesn't cover the existing vacancies that were also cut. In 2004, there was language change to the juvenile registration relief statute. It changed from the 90-day language to 2 years past the end of their supervision. At the end of the historical overview, there's a state comparison summary. I contacted all 50 states over the past week. 36 of those states, including Oregon, of course, responded. 34 of those states have public websites. South Dakota does not have a state registry accessible to the public. It's only for law enforcement. Public access is through the counties and on the local level. You'll notice when you look at the summary, 17 of those states post all their offenders. 10 exclude juveniles unless they were tried and convicted as adults. 6 of those states post medium and high-risk offenders. However, 5 of those states are currently looking at legislative changes which will post all of their offenders. 3 states have legislation which goes into effect July 1 of 2005. 7 of those states post high-risk and lifetime offenders only, and 3 post crime-specific. I did not have any information on South Dakota due to the fact that it was at the county level.
The Oregon State Police, Mr. Dallum and members of the committee, is remaining neutral on how Senate Bill, House Bill 3486 in its current form. But I would like to express some issues and concerns that we have on this proposed bill. There are several options that are being considered regarding the identification of the offenders who sex offenders will be posted on the website. One consideration from our sex offender registration partners in the field is to post those sex offenders that are designated as predator or predatory. The state police would not oppose this option, as we understand it would benefit the public and operations of our partners statewide. However, if sex offenders are to be posted on the internet, we would request that the state police post all sex offenders on the internet rather than a smaller section of sex offender population will consist only of those designated as predatory. There are several reasons for preferring the listing of the sex offenders, of all sex offenders, and the idea is to identify the best method for providing information on the internet with the least amount of cost. The current database information could be migrated to the public access with the least amount of cost and effort. The current process for citizens to obtain the offender information is a telephone-based system where citizens request information based on geographic location. The information is then provided by mail containing information such as name, date of birth, and physical description. The citizens' requests for information have usually included requests for information for all sex offenders and not just specific to predatory sex offenders. By limiting the information available on the internet, the only way to continue access to the majority of the sex offender database would be by using our current non-internet-based method. The posting of only certain section of sex offenders on the internet would require changing the format of the information released to the public. This would increase the overall cost of the internet implementation. So it's difficult to provide exact costs for the implementation of the internet-based system without defining exactly what the system will be or how, you know, who will be posted on the internet. But in attempting to assist the committee define the general needs that will be required for us to address the issues of this bill, we came up with the approximate cost of $190,000 every biennium. Now this would include one information technology position to support the system and the work on the system design. These costs are now identified as part of our current budget requests, which of course further our put further stress on our resources. So, well, anyway, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Any questions from the committee? I see Representative Olson here. If we could ask you to stand down, get our questions. I would like to help him with his schedule if I could.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon, Representative Olson. I'm sure hoping to have a committee meeting after I ask the good people from the Highway Department to step down.
That's good. Well, no, revenues.
Thank you.
Yes.
It's yours.
Mr. Chair, committee, thanks for this opportunity today. I just want to give you a quick little brief how I'm here today. A couple months ago, and I see a constituent of mine and a grandfather that lives down in my house district, Tom Cordier, is back here in the audience, and he's scheduled to testify too today. But Mr. Cordier brought this issue, predatory notification, to my attention a couple months ago, where he was concerned basically with the idea of what was happening with just being able to access who was listed as a sex offender, specifically predators in his area, in the North Albany area, Benton County, and Linn County. And in the process of doing that, he found a lack of consistencies that occurred for the notification process. And as a result of that, we Mr. Cordier and I arranged a meeting with some of the officials from both Linn and Benton County to discuss this issue, but also to kind of share more of our concern of what we really needed to have for awareness. I mean, I want to be sensitive enough too with this, especially for the offenders that are coming off supervision, that are on supervision, that they are not impacted to such a degree where they are still being able to be restored back to society and everything, but also have the opportunity to get their own lives on track. But specifically targeting the high-risk offenders is what our intent was on this whole issue. About 2 weeks ago, Representative Crummell was sharing with me this bill that he was introducing that we're at this point now with. And actually, it was very similar to where I was wanting to go. So we started talking, sharing some different issues and everything. The one thing I do like about what this bill does, it identifies a central point of inquiry for the public. I believe the goals that it does do is it develops consistency across the state, maintaining one depository. It also provides protection through awareness for the public. But at the same time, too, it targets the high-risk offenders that I believe are the predators using a specific measurement, being the static 99, which I believe you have that in front of you. And that's what I wanted to share with you, and that's why I support this bill.
Thank you, Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26, which is Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. I won't go through all of the history because you've already been enlightened about that with regards to from the Oregon State Police. I think that one of the things that matter of fact, I think this comes off the Coos County sex offender website, and it's a quote, and I quote, "An informed community is a safer community." And really what we're trying to do here with this bill is to help communities, I think, be safer and more aware. Currently, for a person to get information about sex offenders in their area, as you heard from state police, the system is a little onerous. You make the phone call, they have to collect the information off of a voicemail, they then put together the information for you and mail it out. And I think that's fine, but it seems to me that that would be extremely time-intensive, both for the state police and also, you know, if a person has to go and make a phone call and that sort of thing, they might not worry about accessing the information. However, if it's as close as their internet connection, to be able to go on a website and get information about sex offenders in their area, I think that it may help people actually go ahead and request the information. I think that one of the things that we're really trying to do here is help people be aware of the of other folks that may not be, that might have criminal intentions, I guess is the best way to put it, that are around them. I don't think it's not a fear thing, and I don't think it should be viewed as something as a way of, say, you know, for example, of driving a neighbor out of a neighborhood. I don't think it should be viewed in that way. But what I think it should be viewed as is, number one, if I'm more aware of my neighbors, then I can be more protective in a lot of respects of my neighbors. Second thing is that if I know that one of my neighbors has a problem, I can help that neighbor be more accountable so that they're not going to get themselves in trouble again. And I think that, and the only way I can do that is if I have the awareness of the information. I think putting the information on a website is really a part of that awareness factor. We're actually not, in this bill, in 3486, we're actually not requesting to change the information, maybe a little bit. But what we're really wanting to do is change the medium. So that instead of making a phone call, receiving the information in the mail, a person can go on the internet. You know, I know there's some concern about, well, what if a person in Tokyo wants to get the information? Well, yes, because it's on the World Wide Web, the information is certainly available to somebody in Tokyo. Now, I'm not sure why anybody in Tokyo would want to find out about sex offenders in Oregon, but they could. For whatever reasons, maybe it would be research reasons. I think, you know, when we look at some of these things, you know, how many people in Clackamas County knew about Mr. Nimnich? He's a fellow that's been in the news for the last couple of days. He's 82 years old. He's out of Clackamas County. He met a woman in Portland. Took her out to Estacada, tried to strangle her, tried to rape her. She fought back, got away, and was able to hide until he left. He was picked up a couple of days later in Wyoming. The guy is 82 years old. He has been a sex offender since 1940. That is longer than probably everybody in this room has been alive. 65 years this guy has been a sex offender. He's been convicted several times. Now, would the website have helped the lady on Northeast Sandy? Maybe, maybe not. But would it have helped his neighbors to know who was living around him and help him be more accountable? I would argue that yes, it would have, because he would have been on there. Because he would be, I think, what you would consider one of our more dangerous predatory sex offenders. But the point here is that information is power. And when you empower people with the information, they can act on it, or at least they have a raised awareness level. So that's why I support the bill. Why we drafted the bill. Several of you have signed on to it, as well as several of our colleagues in the House and the Senate. I think the bill has bipartisan support. I'm not going to talk any longer because there's other people that want to talk also, and I think that their comments will be even more meaningful. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions for either of the representatives?
Hello.
Representative Burley.
No questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either one of you could answer this. I'm looking at the amendment, and this has, starting line 14, determined to be a predatory sex offender as provided in ORS's And then it's pursuant to rules. So can you tell me, does this bill provide any expansion of what can be determined or what can be defined as a predatory sex offender other than what's already said in statutes?
No.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'll go ahead and answer that. And listen, you want to have it. The answer is no. It's not expanding what's determined as a predatory sex offender. It's what's already in statute. But what it is doing is allowing the agency. So, you know, state police, for example, would like to post everyone. And actually, because of the database they already have built, that migration standpoint, that might make a lot of sense. The parole and probation officers may only want to see, and they'll talk about this a little bit, may only want to see the most dangerous people put on the internet. Well, I think the key here is for both organizations to be able to sit down and discuss it and make a determination, and what this amendment will do is give them that flexibility so that by rule they can determine who's going to be who they're going to post on the web and who they're not going to post. And that's what we're trying to do, because we want the state police to be able to work with their partners, which is the county corrections or community corrections, the Department of Corrections overall, as well as the county parole and probation officers. And by being able to work with their partners, I think they're going to be able to come up with the best solution.
Follow up,
Representative.
So I'm, you know, I'm a mom of two young girls. I mean, I want a big red X on the doors of sex offenders. But the sex offender status is a pretty huge thing to carry around for the rest of your life. And we're, you know, considering bills this session about, you know, getting a hospital or any healthcare facility relicensed and renewal or licensed cannot at all hire anybody who's ever been, you know, sex offender or convicted of sex offender. What I'm concerned about is I don't see that juveniles are treated any different. And, of course, Measure 11, which is sex offenses where juveniles are tried and convicted as adults, you know, I can understand why you wouldn't treat them differently. However, I think isn't there an argument to be made to why you have a 15-year-old and stupid, you know, Measure 11 mistake. I'm looking at all the abuses sexual abuse in any degree. So sexual abuse in the third degree, this is a person commits a crime of sexual abuse in the third degree if a person subjects another person to sexual contact and the victim does not consent to sexual contact. So let's say two 15-year-olds, you know, do stupid things, and so a 15-year-old gets convicted sexual abuse in third degree, Measure 11, goes to prison for, you know, how many months, 70 months. Then on top of it is, you know, now a predatory sex offender and has this additional, labeling on him or her. I mean, at what point do we look at these juveniles as juveniles in this system, and at what point do we just pile so much on them that there's no motivation whatsoever to ever rehabilitate? I can see for the adults, but I just think we should treat differently with the children.
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Worth, I understand what your thoughts are regarding that and everything, but that's what the static 99 measurement is designed for, and to allow the local community corrections to determine that. And I understand too that you might have that juvenile that will do a very stupid thing. And they might very well escalate them into a Measure 11 offense. Does that mean, though, that they're going to be eligible to be on this high risk? That's going to be determined locally. And it could very easily be that through that determination, using the static 99 measurement, that they don't fit in that high risk because it was a stupid thing and it was a one-time thing. This is designed specifically, and what this law is created for is designed specifically for the high-risk offenders.
I would also like to point out, if I may, Mr. Chair, I believe, and Representative Worth, I believe you said 70 months.
I don't know.
Under Measure 11 or whatever it is. But let's kind of figure it out here for a second. If you're 15 years old and you commit a crime to which you do get 70 months worth of time, you are no longer a juvenile when you come out of the system. You are now a full-fledged adult because you reach the age of majority at 18. 70 months added on to 15 years is, well, let's see, 70 months is about 5 years and 10 months. So you would be almost at the age of 21, if not at the age of 21 or 22, when you came out. The other thing is that there are a juvenile that's not charged with a Measure 11 crime is going to be remanded back into juvenile court, and the rules there are different than they are in adult court. So that the juveniles are already handled differently in the statutes than they. Matter of fact, I asked legislative council specifically about this issue, and that was one of the things that that legislative council talked to me about, was that juveniles are handled differently in this regard. Now, if they are charged with a Measure 11 crime, and now they're basically charged as an adult. If they're between that age of 12 and 14, I believe there is a special waiver that has to be for them to leave juvenile court. There's a special waiver that the court has to grant. But there again, if they're incarcerated for a length of time, by the time, even at the age of 12, by the time they would come out, they most likely are going to be over the age of majority, so they're no longer considered a juvenile.
Follow up. And I understand that, but I'm talking, my concern is for those small portion of juveniles, minors, who spend their entire sentence at McLaren and they get out as juveniles. And again, I just think I think you're going to try and fit everybody who possibly could qualify in here. And, you know, just thinking off the top of my head, what happens if this kid's a juvenile, comes out a juvenile, and doesn't have a car of his own, drives his parents' car? Is his parents' car going to be then the type of vehicle that's plastered all over the internet? And I think that that's just a huge burden to be carrying around for the rest of your life if you're a juvenile. Just additional. I'm repeating myself, but I just think that's, even if we're going to err on the side to protect, you know, these few juveniles, then I think we should do everything we possibly can to make this, you know, not a life debilitating thing, because they do have a lot of years ahead of them.
Chair Dohm and committee, there are some people in the audience here that could actually address this a lot better than what we've just done.
And I think
actually relieve some of your fears, I think, for what you have, Vice Chair Wirth. So.
And also, Mr. Chair, I do know that, or I think anyway, that Legislative Council is monitoring this, and Virginia Vanderbilt is the council that drafted this for us, and she's the one that I visited with a little bit, and I'm sure that if we asked for her to come up, she would be glad to come up and talk a little bit about the issues that Representative Wirth is talking about as well, that she would answer a lot better than I can.
Let's see what the rest of the testimony brings. Representative Burley, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And somebody else may be better answering this question, but ORS 181-592-4B already says that the department may use the Internet to make certain information available, which in the Dash 1 amendment, we're not even changing that. We're just adding the additional mandatory Internet reporting pretty certain to more egregious offenses. But I guess my question is, why, if the OSPs had this May authority all along, why have they not done it? And also, do we maintain different registers in the state? You know, if we have in this packet, we've got county Internet sites, and we're talking about one with OSP. Are these different registers? And if so, do we need to address perhaps some consistency between that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Brilley. Yes, there are some different changes, and as a matter of fact, I have I've already given Representative Witt one, but I have for both Representative Brilley, you, and Representative Wirth, a copy of the web pages out of your area that shows the sex offenders in your area. So there are some counties that do have that information up and available on the internet. There does need to be some consistency, and where in the statute the state police is given that authority, it really to have sort of and set up the consistency across the state, that really it really makes sense to have them have the central registry, which they actually already have. Why they have not gone to the internet, I think, was answered a little bit by Mr. Salazar and Ms. Beatty when they talked about the budget cuts and also the court case that was started in 2000 or 2001 and then wasn't resolved until the Court of Appeals resolved it in 2003. So I think between those two things, but you know, at this point the state police has the authority and they're not using it. What we're suggesting here is that they use that authority, and we're not suggesting it actually, we're directing them then to use that authority and put this information and to be the central repository.
Thank you.
I would say also, if I may, Mr. Chair, that having this, the federal government has been talked about by U.S. Attorney General Gonzalez, is wanting to have a website up for a national registry within the next 6 or 8 months. Oregon and South Dakota have been identified as the only two states in the country that they would not be able to link to, and the reason why is because we don't have a website for them to link to. The other side to that is for our state system, for our state website to be able to link to the county websites, so that there's really the interplay of the information, and you can go to any one of those repositories in and get the information that you're looking for. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Mr. Worth promised me it would be
one
little question.
Sorry.
We're anxious, Kelly.
Representative Olson sees some familiar faces in the audience. I see some familiar faces here on the internet. High school classmates. And actually, when on campus, and I bumped into them. So Benton County is fortunate that we do have, I peruse this thing all the time. And so I want some idea of how this would be different, how it would be a more narrow classification than what we could possibly already do with the Oregon State Police. And tell me what's the least offensive offense that could qualify under this new least.
Yeah, Pat. Pat Schreier would be just an outstanding person.
I think that question might be better directed.
Because we've worked with him and a number of other parole and probation folks, Vice Chair Worth, and they're actually going to be able to give you a good view of who they would like to see targeted as being on this website.
Okay. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, just something that I just realized, and when I hand this to Representative Worth, then she'll also see it. The list that I'm going to give out, like for example, this is 97330 zip code, registered sex offenders on supervision, and it is only a phone list. So it lists the name, their date of birth, sex, race, hair, eyes, height, weight, who they're supervised by, and the date as of. And that's what you would get if you call the state police now and request the information. You would not get, it's, you know, just basically a list. You would not get any other information. So I just wanted to clarify that for the record.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for the two representatives? Thank you very much, Representative Olson. Thank you very much, Representative Krummel. And Lieutenant Salazar, let me ask if there are any questions. Are there questions for the Lieutenant? It doesn't appear as such.
We would like to clarify something.
Okay. Good. Representative Witt had notified me earlier that he would have to go testify on a bill that he's carrying, and I believe that Representative Burley has the same. So when our members get up and leave, it's only because of scheduling issues, they're not tired and overworked. And I myself have to go for just a minute, so I'm going to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Krummel, and thank you.
I see my brother's name here.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have one question in particular that I would like to ask, and that is by and Sam, you testified that you think it would cost about $190,000 to get this up and running. Can you help me understand what that $190,000 is including? And that's, I'm assuming that would just be for the 0507 biennium. So can you help me understand what that would include?
Yeah,
Yes, Representative Comolli, that is correct. Basically, that's for that the next biennium. And that basically, in a nutshell, like I said, it's very general because we can't be specific until we can identify what system it is we're going to use. But for the basically what it consists of would be the system itself, the server, so on, that would be used for it, and one position, one full-time employee position in the IT section to basically support the system.
So one full-time position and one...
And the software associated with providing basically servers and the power supplies and related infrastructure, such as firewalls and security that's going to be required provided. Basically, the design of the system and the system itself, and then the one support position to support the new system.
And how much then of that one full-time position then, how much would be transferring over from other positions that are already putting out the information like what I just handed to Representative Burley and Representative Worth?
I'm sorry, I missed your question.
Well, so right now, if I call in, it takes somebody some amount of time. I don't know how many man hours you're using now or how many FTE you're using now to harvest the information off the voicemail. So if I call in, there's going to be a voicemail that I'm going to leave my information on.
Right.
When that information, so if somebody harvests that off, and then they put together they go to the database, pull the information, make the list, copy it, put it in the mail, and send it out. And also, how many requests are you getting on a monthly basis now?
Vice Chair Cremel, I think the first part of your question was how much of the FTE would support from that expenditure. We're talking one IT position to maintain the system as it is. Your other piece about an FTE was the person who actually pulls the information off of the phone line and does the print up and the send out. That is a totally separate position.
Okay. How many IT positions do you currently have?
You know, I've got an IT person here to probably answer that. I'm not positive. Let me have him step up.
Can I ask a question of this panel real quick? Not an IT question, though. But I just have a non-IT question.
Okay. We'll finish here, and then I'll come to you.
Vice Chair Cremel, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave Komanecki. I represent the Oregon State Police Enterprise Services Section IT Department. We have right now 9 full-time employees. We are understaffed.
Okay. If I may, Mr. Chair?
Yes. Follow up.
Help me. See, I have a website, and I know how much time it takes for folks that I have helping me with that to maintain the website and that sort of thing. Even if I were adding material to that on a daily basis, to say it's one FTE is a pretty big stretch. I mean, that's because you're talking 8 hours a day. The person is 5 days a week at minimum is monitoring, adding to, looking after, and all they would be doing is this one website. And I'm really having a hard time with that. So tell me what other duties besides monitoring this website a person would have. So they'd be monitoring this website and
right.
doing, I'm sure they, because right now, Ms. Beattie told me in my office that, you know, the person that does the copying and everything also has other duties. So it's not really one FTE that's doing that stuff now. And once you automate it, I'm really having a hard time accepting the fact that with it being automated, that it takes one FTE to monitor and take care of this website.
Vice Chair Cremel, you're right. It would not take one full-time employee probably to monitor and manage this website. However, in our current situation, as I said, we're severely understaffed. I myself am taking on a number of different responsibilities. We have I'm doing the work of probably 3 different people right now and not doing it probably all that well. What we'd be doing basically is dividing that up and giving ourselves a little bit, offloading our the work that we have right now onto that person as well.
So what you're doing, if I may, Mr. Chair, is you're saying this one, to do this one task is going to require one FTE, but I'm also going to have the person doing some other things. Of course, I'm not telling the other things that, you know, I'm just going to charge it to this particular program as opposed to charging it across the board to all programs. Is that what you're doing?
Vice Chair Crummell, it would not necessarily take one full-time employee to manage this website and the background, the system administration of the systems behind it. However, because we are so loaded down right now, we wouldn't be able to manage that ourselves without something else falling off of our plates.
Okay, well,
so that person would, they'll be doing the work that they'd be charged with primarily, which is this site, but they would probably be doing other things as well.
Here's what I object to. I object to you saying that this position is only going to be doing this particular job, and we're charging this program only one FTE, when in fact that one FTE, I'm not arguing with the fact that you might need more people in your IT department, but I am going to argue like heck on the fact that this one program is going to require one FTE. And for you to charge one FTE to this program and not charge it across the board, I find very objectionable. Now, the other thing is, if I may, Mr. Chair, is with regards to the software. There are other states that have done this, like 48 of them.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to reinvent the software to do this with, or are we going to use, and what kind of database are we using now?
Vice Chair Crummell, we have, I don't want to get too technical with you, but we do have a database that's been developed by a vendor, the Sex Offender Registration System. I'm sorry?
What vendor?
Tailored Solutions is the name of the company.
Tailored Solutions, mm-hmm. and I mean, is it like a nationally known database type program, or is it you know, one of these that, you know, Tailored Solutions built the database and only they know how to operate it and only they can fix it if something goes wrong, or did we get like one of the national companies that?
It's not a national company, sir. They are local.
Okay.
They're an Oregon-based company.
All right, that's fine. So are we going to reinvent the wheel, or are we going to use the software that's already available?
In deference to time, and we do have a thank you, Mr. Chair. A ton of new information. I hate to shut off the discussion, Representative Crummell, but
probably just as well.
Representative Worth, you have.
Well, I have to yell at somebody now.
Yeah, we want
to. I'm wondering how much. I mean, how much rehabilitation, how much counseling therapy do we provide sex offenders when they're in the correction system, the state of Oregon? Do we try and rehabilitate them? And
counseling? You know, that would be a better question to be asked of the health providers, and that we basically don't work in that field of the counseling portion of it. You know, we address the issues of violation of the law, but as far as the counseling and therapy and so on and so forth, we better question ask of the health providers who work in this area, and there's plenty, there might be some in this room.
We do have some community corrections people coming that might be able to help you out with that.
Yeah.
I did want to clarify, you asked about juveniles in our system. Currently, a juvenile who is convicted in a juvenile court 2 years after the end of their probationary period can go back to that court and request relief from registration.
That was after 10 years or something.
For juveniles, it's 2 years. It was passed in, I believe, 2004.
Okay.
Any other questions for the Oregon State Police? Thank you, Lieutenant, for bringing the people and a wealth of information. We're going to allocate time a little bit. I have five groups, and if I put the people that signed up as one group, six groups, and I'll bring you up as groups and give you about 5 minutes apiece. If you hear the testimony that you were going to give, please scratch it out. We have some people that have come aways. We have some people that this is an imperative topic for them to testify on, and I'd really like to hear from everybody. So I'm going to bring up in the first group Connie Holland and Tom Cordier. And well.
This chair makes me nervous after what you did the first time.
I will keep these people under control.
We're going to be nicer to you because you're not, you know, you're like a regular person.
I do fear that I am the one that probably started all this. And I am.
Would you please identify yourself for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Constance Holland. When I first approached Representative Crummell's office regarding the need for a sexual predator's website, I was asked what my motivation was. I've given that a lot of thought since I was asked that question. Primarily, it's to protect my 20-year-old daughter, myself, my sister, my mother, my nieces, and my nephews, and friends by allowing us to educate ourselves against the dangers that may live in our own neighborhoods. When my daughter was 4 years old, we lived in Connecticut. She was molested by a daycare provider's husband. She'll be 21 in June, and she still remembers it. I consider myself one of the lucky ones, as she told me immediately, and I was able to call the police. Some years later, while I lived in Connecticut, they published their sexual predators website. I was reviewing it with a coworker, pulling up our zip codes. He saw his neighbor, who was a trusted friend and had unlimited access to his children. He was able to discuss specifics of that person's situation with them and make his own determination on how he chose to handle that relationship and how to protect his family. My brother was raped at a youth camp by a friend of the family at the age of 6. He never told anyone until he was 24. He felt that somehow he was responsible for what happened to him. He began self-medicating with illegal drugs to cover the pain and the guilt he felt. He's now in the federal prison system. I watched my mother blame herself for putting my brother in these circumstances, as if she could recognize a sexual predator on sight. See, I'm not concerned about protecting their rights. As a resident and a taxpayer of the state of Oregon, I am concerned about receiving the best information the Department of Corrections and Public Safety agencies can give me to protect my loved ones. I have received the spreadsheet supplied by the state police and found it to be worthless. The physical descriptions could fit many different people, and I'm not the type of person to stalk someone's residence for their identity. I've worked in technology for almost 20 years. I find it unbelievable that a state that boasts our technological advances cannot produce a website accessible to the general public. I don't know any households that do not have a computer. And there's always the public library. I read a research paper that was written by A. Harris and R. K. Hansen for the Ottawa, Canada Public Safety and Emergencies Preparedness that estimates 26% of sexual offenders will reoffend in their lifetime. As I understand, that's a low number. Do the math, and the statistics are scary. If we have an estimated 16,000 offenders in Oregon, both free and incarcerated, that means 4,160 of them will reoffend. Who's going to be the next victim? I would like every resource available to protect my family and my loved ones.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tom?
Thank you. My name is Tom Cordier. I live in Albany. I've been working this issue for about 5 months. I wanted to make sure that there are some details that people really need to understand. And so I'm going to bore down a little bit from some of the stuff that you've heard already. When you go on, and say, a sexcriminal.com website, you find the offer of the Oregon State Police with a phone number to call. And you get, if you ask for lists, you get, by zip code, a list of all sex offenders who are off supervision. And there's a column in the list that designate that is a P for a predator. Okay? You also get another list of people who are on supervision that basically gives you no information and says, and they say, well, we aren't allowed to tell you which ones are predatory. And so I go to the Lynn, and I live in Benton County, but I'm looking at Lynn County. And I go to Lynn County and try to get that information from them of people who they supervise. And what you have to do is you have to go into their office personally and look them in the eye
and now I'm going to say something that I should have said when I first started. My face coloring isn't a function of my blood pressure. I'm undergoing some chemical therapy on my face for skin cancer, and I'm recovering from that. So that's what's given me the color. Okay.
So we shouldn't worry about your blood pressure.
That's right. It's not a blood pressure issue. Maybe some intensity issues, but it's not that. Okay. So when I go into Mr. Rick Berge's office in Linn County, in Albany, he decides whether he will give you information or whether he won't. He looks at you and talks with you, and apparently I came across okay, and he went through his sheaf of information and allowed me to write down a P on the lines that the state police gave me for people who are off supervision. Okay? For 97321, there are 18 predators out of 74 who are on supervision. For the people who are off supervision, only 3 of the 107 for 97321 are predators. We heard earlier, well, we want to give information on all sex offenders. Listen, it's the predators that we need to worry about. I have that as my own opinion, but it's been formed by talking to parole and probation people both in Linn and Benton County. And I applaud Sheriff Swinyard for, in his words, we knew we had to do the right thing in Benton County to publish this information. And to Representative Worth's concern about what do you do about this young kid who made it a bad decision and now is going to live with him for the rest of his life, what Sheriff Swinyard told me personally is that that's why they have a team of people evaluate these people. And he assured me, not that I was even asking, but he said, for example, we would never put even a 19-year-old on this list who had consensual sex with a 15-year-old. He wouldn't be listed as predatory. So what Sheriff Swinyard is saying is his parole and probation department manages the classification of these people because they understand your concerns. So those things are being addressed at least in Benton County, they're being addressed that way. Okay, so I'm trying to make sure that when we get all said and done with this website, that it's a complete, comprehensive list of P's, both on and off supervision. For example, if you go to a website called criminalcheck.com and put in 97321 currently, you get this thing called publicdata.com, and it claims to list all of the sex offenders, but it does not. It only lists those people who are off supervision, but it doesn't tell you that. Even Swinyard's laudable efforts in Benton County, that website doesn't tell you that these are only people that he supervises. So that even when you go to this website, you don't know that there are 8 other predatory sex offenders who are off supervision living in Corvallis. That doesn't tell you that. It makes you think that that's all of them, but it's not. And so the devil is in the details. And I come out of private industry. I'm retired at this point. I come out of private industry, and I know when you're getting schmoozed with FTEs and all that, and you were schmoozed today, and you know it, and I know it. And I personally have found the people in the sex offender unit, including one of the people who are here today from that unit, as being obstructionist. When I try to get this information from them, they originally told me that it was against the law for them to for the Oregon State Police Sex Offender Unit to provide to me predatory sex offender lists from the Oregon State Police.
They said it was against the law. And I said, tell me what the law is. So anyway, on my own, I went through another channel, got a copy of the Oregon Criminal Code 181.585, and it finally came to light here today by Representative Burley that the Oregon State Police has had the authority to publish this information for a long time, and they refuse to do it. They have, you know, and when you talk about full-time equivalents, how many people should be getting laid off or keeping lists that are not comprehensive? There's got to be a ton of hours being spent publishing this information, which is inadequate and incomplete. And they have that information available to them. The county parole and probation boards, within 10 days after that board decides that a person is classified as predatory, they must notify the Oregon State Police that they've been categorized as predatory. And yet the Oregon State Police claims they don't have that information. And so what I have in front of me here, in the name of efficiency, what I'm told as a public citizen to do is the following. Again, contacting your local community corrections office for information on supervised offenders is the most efficient available to you. What that says is that I have to go make an appointment with Rick Berge in Linn County, and if he chooses to, he will tell me which ones are predatory. Now, there's another issue here, and I know I'm taking time. I really thank you for your attention. But this is a cable news story. It used to be that all of America waited for the evening news to come on at 7 o'clock, and they chose in three channels. Not anymore. The readership of those shows is vastly diminished over what it was 10 years ago. The cable news, I want the information now. I want it when I want it. Here's a case in point. The Greater Albany Public School System in Albany has schools in both Linn and Benton counties. Let's say it in an easy way. The school district is absolutely passive when it comes to notifying staff and students on sexual predators who are likely to be around their schools. And by the way, police say, well, we want your help, so we want you to notify us when you see them. But they're passive. So GAPS has four schools in Benton County. Greater Albany Public Schools, GAPS. They have four schools in Benton County. Do you think it ever occurred to them to go to Benton County and ask for sexual predator information? No. They thought that Linn County Department of Corrections, Rick Berge, director, was sending them all of the people in GAPS. Wasn't true. So when people go out and ask the questions, I want a list. By the way, somebody said you get a list, but you can also ask by county for data sheets like that. These were sent to me. You could get the data sheets by county. Okay? But people, when people want to get this information, it's difficult for them to get it. And so I'm looking for a coherent, complete system that allows people to get that information, that allows, that will, to me, streamline what the individual county, meaning State Department of Corrections people working at the county level, there ought to be a great number of efficiencies there if we can get this process streamlined. It'll be cost effective to do this. Forget $190,000. It makes no sense at all. It's a myopic view, and it's obstructionist, and I haven't found the Oregon State Police to be cooperative at all. Thank you for your attention.
Are there any questions?
Just quick.
Yes, Representative Worth.
Thank you for your response to my comment, but I'm how I understand it, Sheriff Swinyard may not post this 19-year-old hypothetical who's convicted of a sexual offense against a 15-year-old on this. He might not classify him as a predator and put him on this website, but it was my understanding that wasn't his decision. It's the community's decision.
It's a team of specialists that he's involved with.
Right. So it's not his decision alone. And according to statute, this 19-year-old would qualify as a predatory sex offender, therefore would be eligible and I think pretty likely to show up on
When I started this process 5 months ago, I was told flat out, once you're a P predator, you're always a P. Turns out it's not true. The P's at the county level, parole and probation level, my buddy Andy Olson used this, there's a term, something or other, 99. It's a screening tool, right?
That's correct.
The screening tool that the county parole and probation departments use is a different screen than what Oregon State Police posts as a P. There are different screens. And so it is complicated to that extent. And one of the things that Andy and I talked about when we met with GAPS people and Linn County Department of Corrections and Benton County Department of Corrections was to come up with a uniform screen so that everybody understood what the P was, because that was one of the objections of Rick Berge's group of not providing the information, was that they're required by this screen to put a P on people that they don't want to be... That will have such a downside to this person being on this under this label that they don't want that. So they're looking for a change in that screen so that a P is a common P.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. We'll hear from Community Corrections now. Commander Pat Schreiner. Sergeant Jeff Wood, Gail Newman.
I'm trying.
Chair Dellum and members of the community, I'm Pat Schreiner with the Marion County Sheriff's Office, Parole and Probation Division. I apologize. I'm still learning about the whole legislative process, and I'm so used to so far testifying in front of the House Judiciary or Senate Judiciary. I prepared my written testimony for the Senate Judiciary because of the time. So while that's being passed out, I'll move on. I'm here representing the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors and the Sex Offender Supervision Network, and speaking in support of House Bill 3486 in the amended form. We believe this bill will help establish standards and consistency for utilizing the Internet to post the highest-risk sex offenders who require the most extensive level of community notification. We believe it is appropriate that the state police have such a website, and we believe that we can work cooperatively with the state police to provide them with the predatory sex offenders on supervision who require this level of designation. The Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors recently has committed to providing websites with this level of notification, and we believe the state police could link up to our county websites for those offenders on supervision. We recently had a community corrections meeting statewide, and we moved on this issue, and part of that was from the frequent challenges that I was facing in the House Judiciary by Representative Andy Olson, and I really brought that to that group saying, you know, there's some inconsistencies in the way community notification is being conducted statewide, and it sure would make sense if there was websites listing the most predatory, dangerous sex offenders in all 36 counties. And we got buy-in on that, and so that was part of our belief. Numbers, I, you know, it was hard for me to get numbers exactly. I know when we have looked at the numbers who score out as predatory sex offenders, and the last numbers I have seen, and I know these numbers seem to change a little bit, but the numbers I saw from Department of Corrections as of January 1st was that there was over 3,800 sex offenders on supervision statewide. I know there's around 500 in Marion County, and part of what Jeff Wood is going to do is talk to you a little bit about what Marion County looks like. I'm trying to give you a little bit of a statewide perspective. Of that 3,800, usually the way with our risk assessment and the way we've determined or designated predatory, 20 to 25% of those folks usually score out as predatory. Then what happens, and Marion County is very similar to Benton County, what Sheriff Swingard has Gail Newman and her team doing, is there is a team, and in Marion County it's our sex offender unit and therapists and polygraph folks that sit down, and they staff those cases because they do what's called a community notification plan. Many of the offenders we supervise, even though they have a predatory status, fit what's called a targeted notification based on their sexual offending history, based on their supervision, based on where they're living. And if you look at the variety of laws relative to community notification, you'll find that 181-587 does provide some limits to notification based on a person's performance on supervision and in treatment, and parole and probation is to take that into account. I think statewide, and I'm guesstimating, I think the numbers of people that actually come up as being that high-risk, predatory, dangerous category is probably about 5%. Some counties, it's higher. I know it's higher in Marion County. That is where local community corrections and their local public safety coordinating councils can wrestle with that issue as far as what those numbers should be. The one thing I would be cautious about is, and with all due respect to the state police, is putting all predatory sex offenders on the website. What we know and what I believe we're good at is we are good at taking the sex offenders we have and determining who is the highest risk to reoffend. We can look at their criminal history. We can look at psychopathy. We can look at sexual deviance. And the people that are score up at that level are the people that we're posting, are the people that are predatory, and are the people that need the widest level of community notification. It's not as clean and it's not as simple as the people who score predatory, who just barely score predatory. There are people who score predatory that we consider for the notification plan. We're saying we're not there. And that's where I think there would be problems if we started to put everybody on, because you could get rape three offenders who score predatory who really should not be on that website as a predatory offender and does not need the high-risk designation. I believe we already have the ability to conduct those assessments, to make those reviews. I think there's places, and I had some conversations with Representative Crummell on this, I think there's places where we can make improvements. Some of those improvements in that designation are things that would take some work probably in between sessions. But I think this bill, I should say we think this bill, is a good first step. And we also think that the community corrections websites that designate predatory offenders should be able to link fairly easily to the state police. How they deal with the folks that are off supervision is another issue, and that's really not something that I'm an expert on. We'd be happy to work with state police on our process. We'd be happy to partner with them on this. We certainly have in the past in dealing with these issues, and we'd be happy to work on any administrative rules that would come as a result of this bill. Thanks. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I think I was going to have Jeff kind of talk about the local picture and maybe show you some things of what we're doing.
We'll get through all three of you, and we'll hold our questions until we've heard from all of you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Wood. I'm a sergeant with the Cohen Probation Division of the Sheriff's Office. As part of my day-to-day duties, I'm charged with supervising our sex offender supervision team. In part, as part of supervising the sex offender supervision team, we do community notifications. As part, as some of Commander Schreiner described, our widespread notifications, we have a website. Just for some factual information, we started our website, I think, roughly in 1997, June of 1997. We had it up before then. Actually, it was in reference to Benton County. We liked their website, Community Sex Offender Notification, so much, we copied theirs. We had it up. There were some legal issues the legal counsel brought up, brought it down. But then again, as I said, in 1997, we had it up, and it has been up since. As you can see on the screen, this is the Marion County Sheriff's Office website. We have a direct sex offender notification link. Within the unit as a whole, we supervise roughly 420 sex offenders, divided amongst 7 pro and probation deputies. Of that, we have 69 designated predatory offenders as of a rough count this morning. On our webpage, we have 42 sex offenders that we have done internet, quote, widespread notification on. I think it's already been mentioned again, our purpose isn't to alarm the community or create panic. We sincerely believe that an educated community is a safer community. Going through our webpage, it's as simple as you see a picture, you see a name, you'll get a rough address, but if you want a more detailed informational flyer, you can click on a name and it pops up the official notification page. I should probably digress and go back a step. To get here, you do have to qualify for notification. Commander Schreiner mentioned, and testimony has also mentioned, that we use a validated risk assessment tool, the Static 99, which designates a predatory status for certain offenders. We staff the process in and of itself is we'll staff it within the unit with the treatment provider. Based on, say, victim information, treatment information, police reports, we try to address how can we appropriately notify the community for a particular offender's victim pool. I think that's sort of important to mention, that we tailor make a notification plan based on the needs of the community and how a particular offender accesses his or her victims, for that matter. Once we determine that the offender qualifies for widespread notification, we go through a fairly extensive checklist, including notifying the local law enforcement jurisdiction. We notify the Salem-Keizer School District, community enforcement, neighborhood associations, AA and AA meeting centers. We mail flyers to neighborhood association, local city ward counselors, neighborhood watch associations. We prepare an internet flyer, but before we post that internet flyer, we do door-to-door notification and newspaper notification. Really for no other reason than to practically grease the skids, so to speak, because we don't want community members or neighborhood associations or neighbors to wake up and pick up their paper and see a sex offender is living right next door. We feel that it's to the community's benefit to have that face-to-face connection prior to internet notification. But once media notification is done and door-to-door notification is done, we post the flyer on the internet. We update it periodically if an address changes, or for that matter, I think Commander Schreiner had mentioned, if certain factors, treatment, compliance, change, and there are times when offenders get released, we do notification, and because of their compliance, their behavior, and treatment recommendation, we may not do an additional notification if it so warrants. Again, we tailor make that plan to meet the needs of the offender and the community. Overall, our feedback has been good. One thing I may mention, and as a side note, again, per the ORS, we release all the information like you can see. We give a brief synopsis of the history, when supervision begins, when it expires, what the special conditions are, i.e. no contact with minors, sex offender treatment, submit to polygraph, no alcohol. and who the supervising parole officer is and a contact information number. We also have, as a side note I had mentioned, we have sort of a link, an email link. It's been interesting. We do get some information regarding our offenders that we posted on the our website, but the number one requested information that we get through what we call a proxy email has been, I want to know how many sex offenders live in a particular area. I want to know, you know, who's registered where, and in which in many cases we have to defer to the state police because of their registration obligations. I know I've been brief. Hopefully I've covered most of the points. Once further testimony is submitted, I'll be available for questions.
I'm going to change the protocol I established. Representative Worth, you have to leave in 2 minutes, but you did have a question.
I do. I have a general question for the whole panel. And my concern is that, you know, we're talking about individuals who are not criminals. They're people who have, kind of, you know, they paid the price for the crime that they've committed and fulfilled the sentence that society deems is appropriate for what they did. And so I'm concerned about, I want to know from you all, do you think a sex offender can ever be rehabilitated? And if we're going to this expense and this great length of tracking these folks when they're no longer criminals, why aren't we spending this kind of time and effort on rehabilitating them? And are we? So that would be that.
Chair Dahlem, Representative Worth, and members of the committee, I guess I kind of have a question in response to that. I mean, the people on supervision, I mean, they have committed a criminal offense, and sometimes while we're supervising them, they're still involved with criminal activity. So there is a part of that they're still criminal. But I think the other question is, you know, can they change? Can they modify their behavior? Can they go on and not reoffend? Yes, they can. Prediction is always really difficult. What we can tell you is the level of recidivism, sexual recidivism, for the people that we supervise on supervision is low. However, what we can also tell you is for this highest level of predatory sex offenders, what we also know is the data, particularly out of the Static 99, tells us that for those people who are sexually deviant, and particularly if they're at all psychopathic or sociopathic, their risk to reoffend continues to grow over time. So 5 years after they're off supervision, 10 years after they're off supervision, 15 years, the risk continues to go up. And so I think when we're talking about in this bill, focusing on the highest risk people, the most predatory offenders, and I think we're pretty good at identifying them, I think this is very appropriate.
One quick follow-up. And I guess I would ask if that's the most effective way about going about it, and why are we not trying to rehabilitate these predators? And so that we don't have to have this constant lifetime, you know, tracking and fear and, you know, threat that they're going to lurch out and reoffend.
Are you going to have to run? Or you?
I'll listen to the audio tape, though. I appreciate it.
Chair Dahlem, Representative Worth, and members of the committee, we are. They are in mandatory treatment programs. That's part of what supervision is about. So it's not that the other big issue on community notification from our perspective, and I think Gail Newman from Benton County wants to speak to this a little bit too, but the other big issue is community notification in and of itself. There's no information that community notification increases public safety or changes offenders' behaviors. We just don't have any data that shows that. However, I think it fits another need, and that is the public's right to know information about people who present a risk in the community. And so I think that's really what this is about, more than we'd love to say that it is reducing recidivism. I think it's used as a tool in supervision, but it's just one of the tools we use, and we can't point to any study that tells us this reduces recidivism.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in the interest of saving time, I won't repeat everything that Mr. Schreiner just said, because I wholeheartedly agree.
Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry, Gail Newman, Director, Benton County Community Corrections. I'm here on behalf of Community Corrections, Benton County, and the Sheriff's Office. Representative Worth asked about rehabilitation, and she will be listening to the tape. I want to assure her that all indigent sex offenders in Benton County receive treatment. No one is turned away due to lack of funds. We do support treatment for all sex offenders in Benton County. I agree with everything Mr. Schreiner said, and also agree with Representative Olson that we do, in fact, need a central point of inquiry, and we do need consistency around the state. I think this bill in the amended form would allow for that consistency. We have had a web page for sex offender notification since December of 1996. When we initially got the website up and running, I believe we were the first in the state. We had all kinds of people worried that there would be lawsuits, there would be legal implications. To date, we have not had one legal challenge nor any negative consequence of having that website up and running. We also have had numerous website hits. There is an email link, as there is in Marin County, and we get information from the community who are our eyes and ears for those sex offenders. We get some good information, and we can at times stop violations or new crimes before they happen when we find out that a sex offender is acting out in the community. So I would support this bill.
Thank you. And yes, Representative Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I apologize for asking this question. I'm sure it was probably covered while I was in the other committee hearing, but I'm still left wondering what constitutes a predatory sex offender, and if someone could answer that for me, I would appreciate it.
A predatory sex offender, it's in the statutes 181, 585, a tendency to, one, it's got to be a specific crime category. So it's rape, sodomy, sex abuse, sexual penetration with a foreign object, one, two, or three, or any attempts thereof. And then it is, and really from there, then we're looking at a propensity to victimize others, which obviously all those crimes do that, but that's when we look at this static 99, which starts looking at their history of offending, their criminal history, and some other factors in their life that gives us an idea if this is somebody that's going to go on and continue to offend sexually.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So what we have here are the worst of the worst offenses, and the likelihood that these folks might offend again. Yes?
Chair Dahl, Representative Witt, members of the committee, yes. Again, part of what we're looking at very often is some repetition in that behavior. I mean, you can't have somebody that's convicted of a sodomy one, a rape one, that will not score predatory. Maybe it's their only sexual offense, and they do not have any other significant criminal history, and they may not score predatory. They will still go to prison. They'll still be heavily supervised, but that might not be a predatory sex offense when you look at it.
Follow up. But, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to make very clear that if we're going to be, there may be very, very good reason to alert the public by the internet, because there is a high probability that these folks might offend again in the future, correct?
Chair Dahl, Representative Witt, and members of the committee, correct.
Thank you very much.
Are there any other questions?
I have one question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cummel.
Sergeant Wood, the website that you showed to us here, what software are you using to run that, and what's the platform?
Representative Cummel, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you need to forgive me. I'm not a computer expert. I believe we've just used, I believe it's called Java, but it's through our IT department, created the website from our Marin County Sheriff's, or created the notification site from our Sheriff's Office site. I believe it was up and running within a day. It wasn't, from what I understand, some of the HTML language, internet language is not. The program is fairly user-friendly, and from what I understand from IT staff, it was pretty easy to set up and run.
Mr. Chair, I would like to request, Sergeant Wood, if you could ask your IT department to send to me, or send to the committee, please, what the software is that they're using, what the platform is, and also what the database is. I would greatly appreciate it, because I have a feeling that, you know, you said it probably is JavaScript, which is a very universal language, very easy to program. It probably is some HTML.
In deference to time, I'm going to thank you very much. I'm going to call three people, and I'm not sure you have related stories to tell, but we can just make it Steve Dole, David Work, Walt Beglin. I hope I did that right. And if you will identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Walt Beglaw, and I'm the Marion County District Attorney. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3486. And I'm going to be brief and give the 20,000-foot view here. This is an outstanding concept that really will bring an enhanced visibility to the citizens regarding convicted, I would note again, convicted sex offenders. Personally, as a prosecutor of child abuse for over a decade, no other information, no greater concern to parents is than that of the protection of their children from sex offenders in the community, period. This website will honor that community priority. Now, I haven't done a lot of homework before and worked on this bill, so I really do support the hard work that has been put in to reach its current stage and the local triage process that you get to determining whether you have a serious high-risk offender that ought to be on this website. So this is a long-term benefit. This is really good customer service about a service that is most important in the community. And I would note, in regards to some of the comments around ballot measure 11, it's really not about ballot measure 11. It's about registration for sex offenders, whether a juvenile or an adult, and getting to the high-risk offenders through that. I can tell you countless stories of 16-year-olds who were charged with Measure 11, who had sex with a 4-year-old that ought to be Measure 11, ought to be registered, and that was the appropriate discretionary piece to that. So I'll end there. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Will.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Work. I'm an Internet service provider in Cottage Grove, Oregon. I guess in matter of retrospect, I started a website 10 years ago advertising real estate on the Internet, and since then we've been continuing to do the same thing every day, interfacing with a database that's maintained by the Portland Multiple Listing Service. We've been doing that for the last 3 years. I guess I'm here to serve as a reality check to the Oregon State Police and their estimate that $190,000 can operate a website for 2 years. My guess is it's more like $5,000 or $6,000, to be honest with you. That's a guess. We have software that we've developed and controlled that we deal with on our websites for our customers that can actually produce this type of a website, at least in terms of the way I understand it, if that data was fed to us. I think it's ridiculous to think that a full FTE is required to operate this type of a website. We don't have a full FTE in our office that's allocated to running our real estate website, and our real estate website is fairly complex. We're talking, I think, about replacing data on a daily basis. It's really a no-brainer. I don't think the costs are that relevant. When I was asked to examine what I thought the cost might be, the biggest cost in my mind was bandwidth. As an independent small service provider, if we were to provide this type of website, I think it would be heavily accessed and the bandwidth would be the greatest requirement. I don't think the bandwidth was a consideration in the cost estimate from the Oregon State Police. The cost of the software, the cost of the servers, I think all things considered, it's really incidental. So I think I'd like to leave it at that, other than to say that I think you can make this type of public information easy to get or hard to get. Right now, it's hard to get. and it shouldn't be. It should be easy to get. It should be easy to get on the internet. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Dolan.
For the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole, and I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. I guess it comes down to that. That's the reason we're here. You know, if it weren't for the harm done to the victims, we wouldn't be here talking about all this. But there is great harm done. I came to Crime Victims United because my daughter was a murder victim. But I look at sex crimes as another type of murder, a murder of the soul. I deal with these people, and I deal with the aftermath. I deal particularly with the parents of many children who are molested. And I can't even begin to tell you the grief that is brought onto families as a result of these crimes. In 1994, there was a young girl who was raped and murdered in New Jersey. And that is what really first prompted the demand for the broad-based community notification. That case led to what we now call Megan's Law. It was named after Megan Kanka, who was raped and killed by a known child molester who had moved across the street from the Kanka family without their knowledge. In the wake of that tragedy, the Kankas sought to have local communities warned about sex offenders in the area, and on May 17, 1996, President Clinton signed Megan's Law. Megan's Law has two components, sex offender registration and community notification. The sex offender registration was brought about by the Jacob Wetterling Act, which was passed in 1994, and that requires states to register individuals convicted of sex crimes against children. The community notification piece came about as Megan Law allows the states the discretion to establish criteria for disclosure, but compels them to make private and personal information on registered sex offenders available to the public. You know, we give a lot of lip service in this building and have for the last 6 years since the passage of Senate Bill 555 to crime prevention. And last session we talked about best practices with Senate Bill 267 and what works. And the question comes to me is this. I've seen millions of dollars poured down the rat hole, on crime prevention, a lot of airy-fairy programs. But, you know, the things that I find that work the best are always practical, common sense things. And that's what we're talking about here. I don't want to get into the cost of this thing. I don't know if it costs $190,000 or $19. But you know what? I don't think it really makes any difference, because we're talking about the safety of our communities, and we're talking about the right for victims and potential victims to know if there are dangerous people in their neighborhoods. So, you know, how do you measure the hundreds of crimes that possibly won't happen because parents are more informed, because neighbors are more alert, because people are arming themselves with good information and are more aware of their surroundings? Now, the critics might tell you that a website that features sex offenders will create a false sense of security. You'll probably hear the ACLU tell you that there's privacy problems, and the defense bar will tell you that there's the possibility that people may take retribution. I too have concerns about that, but I only have seen one case of note in the last 15 years when it comes to retribution. As far as I'm concerned, when you commit these types of crimes, you lose a lot, including some of your privacy rights. I know people who in their own neighborhoods have sent for these lists that they can now get without seeing these pictures on the website, and are alarmed to find people, some of who they considered good friends, that they have criminal backgrounds involving serious sex-related crimes. And I might tell you that one of these persons, I don't want to reveal this, but what I want to say is that he's a well-known law enforcement person in this state. And he found himself, when he ordered up one of these lists, that right across the street from him was one of these people, and he was able to keep his children away from those people by getting that list. But of course, it would have been much easier on the website. Now, we don't want to scare people unnecessarily, but just let them make the choices. Let families get the information so that they can make decisions about what is the best course of action for them and for their children. And I might add one thing, Mr. Chair. You know, it's interesting to me that sex offenders have and use the internet to find their victims nowadays. shouldn't we, as law-abiding citizens, be able to use the Internet to find the sex offenders? Thank you very much.
Any questions?
I have one quick question, if I may, Mr. Chair.
One question, Representative Crummell.
Mr. Work, since you operate an ISP, would you by any chance be willing to host and help us out with this, either at a no fee or a reduced fee?
Sure.
Okay. I can't do procurement from here, but you know what?
Other than bandwidth.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, all three of you.
Thanks.
We do have some more people that wanted to testify, and we'll get them up here. Rob Gordon and John Hummel.
What's your pleasure, Chair, on who's first?
Whichever one of you identifies yourself first.
Thank you. Chair Dahl, I'm members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is John Hummel. I'm a criminal defense attorney in Bend, and today I'm representing the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We've heard compelling testimony today about why it's so important to notify the community about what I will call the worst of the worst, these predatory sex offenders or sexually violent and dangerous sex offenders. And my organization agrees. That makes complete sense. If someone's been determined to be the type who may reoffend, that's who we have to notify the community about. And if someone has been determined not to meet that higher threshold and perhaps had a criminal indiscretion when they were younger and has gone through treatment and towed the line and is not a risk, it makes sense not to notify the community about that person for two reasons. One, because we'd run the risk of a crying wolf. If you put out thousands of names, the community probably doesn't pay attention as much as they would if the list was shorter. And also, it might lead to some injustice if somebody had a minor indiscretion in their youth and has towed the line. So we've heard that, and we agree with that. This bill, we have to be cautious, though. This bill could be a Trojan horse, and here's why. Current law provides discretion to the Oregon State Police to notify about everyone. And they're not notifying on their internet about anyone. This bill, I think, recognizes the fact that they're not notifying about anyone. We're going to say they must notify about predatory sex offenders and sexually violent and dangerous sex offenders. The fear is that this bill would require the OSP to take a step of separating those two. There'll be some manpower. How much is debatable, but there'll be some manpower to separate the two. And to avoid that additional manpower, they might say, well, we'll just notify on the Internet about everyone, because then we don't have to take the time to split it up. And because current law does give them the authority to notify about everyone, they can still do that with this law. So whatever this committee can do to put into law, perhaps with a -2 amendment, to say that on the Internet, OSP will definitely notify about predatory sex offenders and sexually violent and dangerous sex offenders as per the -1s, but will not notify on the Internet about the others. That, from our organization's perspective, advances everyone's intent. And that's my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Dahlem and members of committee. My name is Rob Gordon. I'm the sheriff of Washington County. I'm here today representing my office as well as the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and strongly endorse Senate Bill 3486. Many of the things that I was going to touch on today have been hit, but I want to echo the comments made by the Association of Community Corrections Directors and others you've heard today. Some citizens coming up with some very accurate information. And just to throw out to you a local spin on that in Washington County right now, let me give you some numbers. We have 38 folks that are on the list of people who are deemed predatory sex offenders who are currently under supervision of our Community Corrections Department. If you go to the state police and say, how many predatory sex offenders do you have in Washington County, they'll give you a list of 9. and it'll be in that form that many of the previous witnesses spoke of. It'll be a database sheet without photographs, and I would agree with the witness who said that's a fairly worthless piece of paper that people get in the mail. There's actually 1,082 registered sex offenders in Washington County, and so again, if I ask for a list of the predatory offenders, I'll get a list of nine. There's 494 sex offenders that are supervised by our community corrections program, and remember that I said 38 of those have been deemed predatory offenders. Now, when we say we support this bill, our biggest concern is these predatory folks. These are people who, in our opinion, are dangerous to neighborhoods, they're dangerous to children, they're dangerous to women, they're dangerous to our community. And it makes no sense at all not to have the ability for parents to bring up a photograph of those people and give a good common sense caution to their kids, protect their kids in that way, just as they would in saying don't cross a busy street when there's a truck coming. So we strongly endorse this idea of a single source database. We believe it can be done fairly cost-effectively, like many of the other witnesses have said, and it can be done real-time. The programs you've seen from Marion County, Benton County, others, outstanding programs, but we're missing some people. It doesn't matter which county you're in. In Washington County, we're missing a lot of people, a lot of people. There is a system, by the way, in effect, that where the Community Corrections Department, once they determine that these 38 folks are predatory, they'll go out to a neighborhood and they'll say, this person lives in your neighborhood, we've classified him as predatory. So the people that currently live in that neighborhood, they have a good idea of what's going on. But as there's transition in the neighborhood, new homes are built, or new people move into that neighborhood, they don't know that. This database that you're recommending with this bill would solve that problem. I think that's all I have to say today. Thank you for your time and your attention to me.
Any questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sheriff Gordon, I want to ask you a question here from your perspective as someone who represents a lot of law enforcement personnel. We have a proposed bill here that deals with predatory sex offenders. I'm just wondering, from your perspective, would the community benefit at all from having a registry or public access on the internet to a registry of folks who are predators on a host of other crimes, repeat crimes, the folks that continue to break into people's homes, continue to have property theft and damage and those sorts of things? I mean, something akin to a three strikes and you're out, and you get, you know, if it's property theft, you get on a list too.
Chair Dahlem and members of the committee, I honestly didn't come prepared to answer that question, but let me give you my gut on it. There's certain crimes out there, I think, that are very predictable that folks are going to reoffend. I take that back. I wouldn't base it on a crime. I think you would have to screen those people very similarly to what a sex offender is being screened using this tool. So if you look at all of the criminogenic factors involved in these people and a professional screener, determines that this person is highly likely to reoffend in any category, be it mail theft or fraud or breaking into your home, then I don't see that as a bad idea at all. The task at hand today, though, the sex offenders, that's one that I think we can protect our kids and our community on.
You bet. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? That completes the list of invited and signed testimony. Is there anyone else before I close the public hearing? If not, I'd like to thank those of you that testified. I'd like to thank you, Representative Crummell, for your organization. And with that, we'll close the public hearing.
I'd like to say thank you, Mr. Chair, for having a hearing on this, and also to all the people that did come and testify and took the afternoon to be here. I really appreciate it.
We do have a meeting Tuesday. With the business of the House Information Management Technology Committee completed, we'll now adjourn.
Good job, Jerry. So, thank you.